House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Interim Committee on Energy and Environment. Colleagues, welcome back. We have an interesting agenda today, and we're going to go ahead and get started by opening an organizational meeting on adoption of committee rules. Colleagues, your rules are in your packet, non-OLIS. Should be pretty standard. Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Johnson?
Mr. Chair Bailey, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 18, 2013.
Vice Chair Johnson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 18, 2013. Any discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. Close the organizational meeting on adoption of committee rules. And open an informational meeting on impacts of climate change in Oregon. And I'd like to call up Jeff Stone and Matt Wiegert. Excuse me, Mark Wiegert. Weigert. I'm just, you know, it's early. Normally this committee meets in the afternoons. It's 8 a.m.
4:30.
Yes. So. Yeah, I'm complaining to the wrong person.
And yeah. Mr. Chair, if you could please go lightly on the gavel. You know, it's early.
I'll do my best.
Thank you.
Yes. And then on the phone, we have Harry Peterson Nedry. And why don't we start on the phone, and then we'll move to you, Mr. Weigert. All right. So, Mr. Peterson Nedry, please, your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chairman Haley, Vice Chair Johnson. I hope I've got the names right. I don't have any name cards to look at. See if I do.
Doing well.
And members of the House Energy and Environment Committee, I really thank you for allowing me to join this discussion on climate change. I have both sent a biography of me so that I don't have to go into who I am, as well as a written copy of the statement that I'll talk around or use for the next 5 or 6 minutes to raise what the wine industry is impacted on as far as climate change and what we're doing about it and what we hope.
And I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you for a second. I neglected to ask you to introduce yourself at the beginning for the record, please.
Great, thank you. I'm Harry Peterson Nedry, founder and co-owner, the winemaker at Chehalem, a winery based in Newburgh, Oregon. I'm also this year the president of Willamette Valley Wineries Association and have been on the Oregon Wine Board and lots of other stuff. Basically, over the years, the 33 years that I've been in the industry, I've had just about every role in the industry. We are an industry of very collaborative and participatory people, so most of us have roles that embrace just about everything that concerns us as an industry. My bio that was attached to the statement, if you spill it, it correctly paints me as a serious, rather quality-focused, admittedly a geeky scientist type who's been involved in a lot of roles, but especially over the last 14 years or so, as a concerned monitor for climate and what impact it's having on our industry. Our industry contributes just short of $3 billion annually to the Oregon economy, and it's recognized and gives cachet to the state of Oregon because worldwide we are recognized for an ability to grow grapes and make wine that are not really able to be made in a lot of places on Earth. We're very legitimately known as the birthplace of New World Pinot Noir. We emulate the grapes of Burgundy in that respect, and we also make great white wines, also emulating Burgundy with great Chardonnays, and also other regions with Riesling and other grape varieties. This is all possible not because we attract a lot of talented winemakers and grape growers because of where we all have chosen to grow our grapes, because of the climate that we have here, which is amazing, and what is called a cool climate, because of the soils and the other growing conditions that we have. The Willamette Valley, where I live, doesn't really grow all of the grapes that are grown in Oregon. There's some grape growing regions going all the way from Walla Walla and that valley on the Oregon side, the southern Oregon, and down the gorge. However, in the Willamette Valley, we do grow about 75% or so of Oregon's grapes and make about 75% of Oregon's wine. And since I know it best, I'll talk with that as a context. Willamette Valley is a bona fide cool climate growing region. In the viticultural jargon that we all stick around, it's what's called a region one growing region, and it is as low as it goes based on how much heat we accumulate over the growing season. That's really the main measure that people use to understand whether we had the heat to ripen in a certain year or not enough or too much. That is, that's the measure that we use, and it's a measure that I've become attuned to over the years. I first became interested in monitoring climate change in 1999, 2000, right at the turn of the millennium, when a conference in Australia in Melbourne, which continued what every 4 years or so is done around the globe, bringing together people who grow grapes in the cool climate regions of the world. In that international cool climate symposium, they chose to discuss for the first time that I had seen climate change. And being 14 years ago or so, it was rather revolutionary to me, and it was rather startling also. We Valley, and with our cool climate, we're at risk of global climate change. And the main reason we're at risk is the wine that are signature to Oregon, and especially Pinot Noir, and especially the elegant white wines, they will change. The characteristics that make us famous are finesse, elegance, richness, a balance of food friendliness, ageability, the warming, the wet streams that were predicted at the Cool Climate Symposium in Melbourne are indeed with us today. And although many of us hadn't noticed it until they gave that wake-up call. I have a background in statistics, and what that meant is that when I came back, I began monitoring seriously the growing seasons that we were having and had had, and compared them to the history over the last 100 years or more. The Oregon wine industry has been around 46 years or so, 46, 47 years now, almost half a century. Climate change, based on the data that I've seen, is not a point on a political agenda for one party to take shots at the other party with. It is indeed fact. It's scientific fact. And I invite anyone who wants to look over my shoulder at the reams of data that tell us that, and especially with the last almost 50 years of the Oregon industry, we'll see a startling tale of what is concrete change. The industry itself knows that we're a canary in the coal mine, mainly because we farm on the edge. It's not as if we chose the easiest place to grow grapes. We chose the place to best grow the grapes that no one else can grow outside of a very limited range of viticultural areas. The change that has recently given us slightly warmer vintages and short term means that they're a little bit more predictable than they used to be, it really changes our style and jeopardizes that. that hard-won position that we have in the wine world. Plus, the scary thing is that we don't easily have a way to stop or slow down the rate of change. And I would say that that is yet. I have great optimism that we'll find a way. I'm an optimist, or else I wouldn't be working hard in this arena. I would just give up. Our industry is actively involved also, incrementally, in trying to affect change. We were the first industry to join the governor's office's carbon neutral challenge. We embrace renewable energy, whether it's wind or solar. All you have to do is drive around the wineries in Oregon, and at most of them you'll see solar or wind installations. We push the limits of sustainability and reducing the inputs to our processes, whether it's sprays in the vineyard, bottle weight reductions, other alternatives to the use of bottles, water-saving technologies, ways of guaranteeing the cleanliness of effluents, LEED certifications for new buildings and designs that are energy efficient, and a lot of additional things that we could enumerate. As our cool climate changes, our varietal mix, our wine styles, and our ability to grow grapes as we did before are impacted. However, vineyards and wineries are beginning to adapt also, whether it's consciously or subconsciously. We're experimenting with new clones and new varieties. We're pushing new vineyard sites up in elevation on the existing hillsides we're planted on, which was not feasible before or desired. We couldn't ripen that high in elevation. Now it's not a problem. We are also planting on the north side of hills rather than just the south side to maximize heat. So we're trying to get away from some of the heat. And we continue to investigate regions for new sightings of vineyards, some of these regions crawling into the Coast Range and also in the Cascade foothills, not just satisfying ourselves with the hillside inside the valley. This adaptation helps, but it is admittedly short and medium term at best. Long term requires a unified societal effort that we as an industry want to be a part of. In summary, we don't grow grapes easily here. Our farming is on the margin. Cool climates are by definition balanced precariously, and that's why resulting wines are so incredible. The most beautiful things in the world are delicate. So it is with Oregon's signature wines. What we've crafted in almost 50 years can be hurt very easily. We need a coordinated approach to attacking climate change. We'd love to help. We look forward to your direction. Thank you, and I'd love to entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it. I think we'll go through and take testimony from our other two panelists and then open it up for questions. Please, Mr. Weigert.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Mark Weigert. I'm a co-owner of Whiskey Creek Shellfish Hatchery, Neatarts Bay, Oregon. And what we try to do there is we try to provide the West Coast with shellfish larvae. And we probably, just off the top of my head, we're probably supply 75% of the West Coast shellfish producers with larvae. Just for your information, larvae are the first stage in making either oyster, clam, gooey duck, or mussel seed. Without it, you cannot produce seed. So my testimony today is the effects of, I'm going to say ocean acidification on my business, not climate change, and I'll tell you why later. Back in 2007, we had a near-death experience business-wise. We did not produce any larvae for 4 months. This was approximately one-third of our season. And we had no idea what was going on. I mean, we were pulling our hair out. We were freaking out. And anybody that has ever talked to somebody that's had a near-death experience, when you come out of that, life's not the same. And it's never been the same for us since. What we determined with the help of Oregon State and the state of Oregon itself, Betsy Johnson in particular, was that we had a pH problem with our water. And this was not an easily identifiable problem because my wife, who is I consider one of the best at in the business, had never seen anything like this in her 30 years of experience. So she did all the things that she knew how to fix the problem, and of course nothing worked, which forced us to just back up and try to figure out what was going on. In 2007, ocean acidification really wasn't something that was talked about a lot. And since it wasn't talked about a lot, obviously we didn't know what it was. But it became pretty obvious through monitoring, and the gentleman before me, he spoke of monitoring. This is basically what saved us is our ability to monitor the water. And the reason we can monitor is because Oregon State, once we convinced Oregon State it was a pH problem, Oregon State put in equipment to actually let us see what was going on in our incoming water. And right away it became very apparent that the pH was all over the place. When we started teasing out the other problems, we realized we had a dissolved oxygen problem. The aragonite saturation was way off. It was up and down. In other words, you really couldn't use the water like you used to. You just couldn't bring it in, spawn your oysters or clams, and then expect them to grow in these static tanks. What used to be is no longer. And so this, my wife made a comment once, which I always, whenever I have to give this testimony, she said that throw the book out on how you grow larvae because it's a new ocean. We've got to recalibrate what we're going to do here. And I think that most of the testimonies you'll probably hear today is really about people's ability to adapt to these changes. And this is exactly what we did, is we started adapting. And so one thing we did was, the simple thing to do is, well, when you see the water's bad, you just don't use it. I mean, you wait until the water gets better, until all the parameters look good, then you bring it in and you use it to change your larvae with. That was the first thing we did. And they had me running around with beakers, dumping in soda ash to try to balance the pH of the water, and it was, it was a pain in the neck to try to do this. But it worked, we're talking the Stone Age, even though it was 6 years ago. Well, Oregon State, again, they engaged themselves into this process, and then we started, putting in better buffering systems, and when you start talking about pH problems, that's like somebody saying, well, you got a blood pressure problem. Well, what's causing the blood pressure problem? What's driving all that? And this is exactly what's going on with the ocean water, is that if you do have a pH problem, you have to tease out the problems if you're going to grow larvae. And so then we realized right away that it's not just, there's a dissolved oxygen problem with this component. So that wasn't too hard of a fix because, you just inject more oxygen into your system. The old timers say, oh, you can't aerate your tanks too hard because it'll disturb the larvae. And we thought, oh, what the heck, we're going to die anyway, so let's just go for it. And it worked. And also we do ozonation, use ozone and things like that to try to up the oxygen in the water. When you have a low DO problem in a tank, if you shut the air off, the air will drop, or the oxygen level will drop right down immediately. There's something about dissolved oxygen that is tough to attain unless if you don't keep it going, it'll just go away. So this is a problem with the ocean as well. And again, we're just pulling in this water and we're using it to try to grow larvae. So I'm often asked, I try to get pulled into the debate about climate change, and you know, it wasn't so long ago that I thought climate change was just the change of the seasons, you know, four times a year you got, you know, different climate, you know, quarterly. But personally, and this is just my opinion, but I think the climate is being affected by the oceans. Now, if you have a change of chemistry in the ocean, obviously the ocean is 74% of the surface of the Earth. How can it not have an effect on the climate? And so I think people get ahead of themselves when they worry about climate change, and they really got to back up and go, well, what's driving the climate change, you know? If you got a change in the chemistry of the ocean, which is what we're seeing right now, I mean, we don't make this stuff up. We're just trying to grow larvae. If the chemistry of the ocean's changing, it's driving everything that's going on in the climate right now. So that's my opinion. You know, you can throw me out if you want, but that's my opinion. I think as policymakers, it's only fair to ask, you know, when you get this information, what do you do with it? You know, I think somebody along the way said after they heard all this testimony and whatnot in another hearing I was in, say, well, I got all this information about climate change, acidification. What do I do about it? What would be the next step? And it's a tough ask, you know, because you're not responsible for the world's problems. At least I don't think you are. But this is driven by a world economy. But I think Oregon, to me, Oregon has stepped up to the plate and taken the lead on this thing in a lot of different directions. We get referenced in many different articles, and if it wasn't for the fact that Oregon stepped in and helped us out financially, as well as give us the expertise, we wouldn't have a voice in this situation. So I think the short answer is to support the research in this thing, support the monitoring, because if you don't have the monitoring and you don't have the data, you can't make a good argument about what's going on. It's just somebody talking about climate change, which unless you have that data, you don't have a voice. But once you have that hard data, you can start, you know, pushing this thing. And I think that is my 5 minutes up?
Anyway, like to wrap up.
I appreciate the chance to talk this morning. I know I only got 5 minutes, and this gentleman's probably got something more important to say than I do, so I'll close with that.
We thank you for your testimony, and on behalf of a panel of politicians, nice to hear you say the phrase, you're not responsible for all the world's problems. That's about the nicest thing we can hear. Mr. Stone, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Jeff Stone, I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. Other than our conversation that we've had, most of you would probably expect me to be part of a Bon Jovi cover band singing Living on a Prayer rather than being here before you this morning. But there are real consequences. And I am appreciating sitting next to this gentleman today. That's a very real example, and I'm going to try to give you a couple examples in what the nursery industry is trying to do about it. So for us, changes in the climate, our folks have come to the realization that it is happening. So what does that mean economically for us? Well, first, what changes with warmer weather coming into Oregon, that changes the mix of pest and disease issues that we will face. So as we ship our product all throughout the United States, we have additional challenges of pests and diseases that can be market crushing if you do not get on top of it. So we're trying to keep an eye on those changing landscapes in terms of the pest and disease problem. Second, and it's an issue that's dear to many of you in this panel, is water. If we have less snowpack, that means that it's going to be rain that comes and goes down the river. So we have to be far more insightful on how we store water in the future, especially for industries such as ours, which is water is very critical for our existence. We need to start factoring in climate change in how we do water storage in this state. The third thing is that we have an example from the state of Florida. They believe, and they have been able to do through their transportation projects, to have trees and shrubs along highways as an environmental offset. I believe that as we look at conditions much like my friend here had, we need to look at conditions that contribute and look at realistic ways to try to mitigate that. Now, of course, I'm the person selling the trees and the shrubs, so I particularly like that. But I think that we need to look at all options when we go forward. So what is the nursery industry doing about it? In May 2011, my board passed two measures for us to engage. First, we wanted to reduce our energy use by 25% in 10 years. It's a heck of a thing for a board to say, okay, go, you know, we want this policy, and then now it's up to me to make it happen. So we have engaged a variety of different energy companies about how we become more efficient. What are barriers? And so when we're looking at the cumulative impact of what causes climate change, we want energy as a part of it. The second is that we engaged in what is called the Climate Friendly Nurseries Project. First of its kind in the country for the nursery industry, clearly a leader. And we want to try to look at what parts of the nursery operation we can do in order to reduce our carbon footprint. Frankly, when we started this, we didn't even know what our carbon footprint was. We know that we grow trees and shrubs and we send them all throughout the United States, but it's not the same metric as a stand of forests. So it's harder to do the math. But we did know that we can measure what we do. And so we had 13 nurseries over the course of 3 years measure their what they do. We had people on site from the environmental and a variety of other consultants to come onto the nursery. The good news, after 3 years, those nurseries dropped their carbon gas emissions by 20%. Just by doing best management practices. So that is, I just want to say that is one part out of many that we can look at as each industry looks at how climate change confronts them, what challenges it provides. But the secondary question is about what do you do about it? We're not going to save the world. You're not going to save the world. But we all can do a part. And so my message to you today is there are economic consequences to climate change. Either through trying to have water for industry, or what kind of pests and diseases we face in terms of how we grow our plants and what we grow as plants. So I thank you for your time. I had about four more pages, which I will spare you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to welcome Mark's almost a constituent. He was a constituent, but he's close, but redistricting kind of cut him off from my district, but welcome.
My fault.
Wasn't my fault. That's right. But he's a little bit modest as to the importance of his particular business in this industry. I don't know all the numbers or anything, but I know that they're crucial to the worldwide production of shellfish larvae. So this was a big deal, and he did all he could, he and his wife, before coming to us, but, you know, Oregon State has, I know there are ducks out there, it's okay, but Oregon State really did step up to the plate, and Mark is a poster boy for some of this stuff, and the reason why we are so strong on promoting research, and that's one of my highest priorities, so, and I have to say, this guy is asked, like a lot of people in business, to donate to all kinds of events. You know, and my God, he can cook an oyster.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for the testimony. The Economist magazine 3 years ago had an incredible summary on the acidification of the oceans and the challenge that presented. And my recollection of the article was that it's hard to reverse. And so my question to you is this a situation best approached by what Oregon State did, which was to develop a means of responding to a condition? Or is it that we should be trying to reverse what appears to be a world bent on moving ahead? Like when we visited China, it's obvious those folks want electricity. So it seems to me that the creation of carbon and thus the increasing problems with our ocean, something hard for us in Little Oregon to reverse. But I'd be interested in both of you guys' comments, because when your testimony focused on a response to a condition about which we have little that we can do to change, and yours focused on maybe we should try to reverse what the rest of the world's doing. So I want to know, where should we focus our limited resources?
Well, in response to your question, I think we need to lead by example. The United States, I mean, everybody worries about what goes on in Hollywood. Why, I don't know. But I think by leading by example is how do you reduce carbon emissions? You know, we obviously know that we use way more oil than we're supposed to, but understanding that this drives our economy. So what you have to do, in my opinion, is start creating energy-efficient ways of doing things. In other words, you know, how do you scrub the CO2 out of the air? Because this seems to be what's loading up in the ocean. And, you know, everybody wants to say, well, it's China's fault or this, those guys' fault or whoever, they, you know, pass the buck type thing. The one thing I do know is the Chinese like seafood, and you know, you got to send the message out there if you want to keep your seafood chain going. Maybe we got to clean up the air a little bit. It needs to be kind of a, you know, worldwide discussion. But I think where we sit right here in Oregon, We have the information. We have examples of what we're trying to do. I mean the reason I say this is because I get customers from all over the world that want larvae because they simply can't grow it. And I'm not about to give them away my secrets, you know, because I can sell more larvae. But the fact is that it is getting harder to grow larvae, but you have to use the information we have, such as the data that we're getting from our monitoring systems, to really say, yeah, there is a problem. Because to be honest, most people do not know that there's even a problem. They just go along and it's like everything's okay. But I think, you know, like Representative Boone said, is that Oregon State, they actually are leaders in this issue. And, you know, how do we engage the young people in this process? Because the water I'm using right now is 50 years old. Okay, so that means that if you look at the graphs, every year the water's going to get a little bit worse. And so we have to adapt to that. And that's why we didn't have much time to really get on this thing and really get, otherwise we'd be out of business. So we need to engage the young people, the smart people, the very brightest students that we have, I think, and provide them with scholarships to work on this problem. Because it's not just affecting me, it's affecting this gentleman's business and probably anybody else that gets up here that has a testimony today. We got to get a handle on this thing, and the more we understand about it, the reason I'm in business is because I understand the problem. And how do you reduce emissions, you know? Well, that's a tough one. You know, your population is growing every day. But I still think that, I mean, who the hell knows what goes on a computer? You know, somebody figured out how to run that thing. Why can't we put the energy and dollars into figuring out how to clean up the air or reduce the emissions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, very quickly, all of our programs are completely voluntary, the energy reduction, the climate-friendly nurseries project. What we wanted to demonstrate to our fellow nursery states is that you have the ability to tackle this problem. It's not too big for you. But what we're trying to espouse here is that we would like to do our part to help solve the problem, not putting any other burdens on any other industry, but what can we do? And so that was our purpose for the Climate Friendly Nurseries Project and the 25% reduction in energy, because we felt that those were both part of a sustainability roadmap for us, and that's what we're pursuing.
I'm curious to ask all three of you, actually. Mr. Weigert, you talked about some of the steps that you went through to try to change the pH of the water. Mr. Stone, you've talked about the challenges that nurseries face with pests. So it would seem like each of these things are associated with costs. Mm-hmm. Have there been costs to your business from the challenges that you faced from a changing climate or changing ocean?
Yes. There is a cost, and particularly it's a very costly when you don't understand the problem. Because you can open up an aquaculture book or a catalog, and they'll sell you anything and swear that it'll fix your problem, but that's not the way it works. You have to understand the problem that you're dealing with. In my case, it's water. These other guys they're on the land, you know, they got bugs crawling all over them and everything else. And what's the driver behind all this? But yes, there is a very expensive cost. And not only that, but where we didn't produce for 4 months, your costs don't go down. You know, the meter's still running. It's just, we're all of us that are in business, we have to produce. And so that's the challenge that we have is producing with these changes. And I can't speak for, you know, the nurseries or anything else, but for us, what worked was simply having monitoring equipment that actually lets you see what's going on, because you do have windows of opportunity. Leave it at that.
Mr. Chair, please go ahead.
Harry, the invisible one there.
Please go ahead.
I would like to underscore one or two of the excellent points that the other speakers have made. I think there are definitely cost impacts, and yet the focus probably is following the trail to avoid the cost of not doing anything. And yet, one of the things that we found in the industry is that the more we dive in and look at some of the things that will improve the environment and emissions and all of the things that are causing the problems we have, the more we find some efficiencies also. One example of that is our realization that we were packaging our wines in fantastically beautiful but very heavy glass, up to 850 grams per bottle. And then we scratched our heads and said, why? Is it just to impress someone? And so we're using a bunch more glass and energy in the process of making the glass. And in shipping it, we're losing about 10 to 15% of our capacity to ship, and therefore raising our carbon footprint over what we now are using, which is around 500 grams of weight of glass per bottle. So those are the sorts of efficiencies that end up saving us money at the same time we end up at the same time that we embrace the specific cause. I would also like to suggest that I think our role as far as the state is concerned, and possibly yours should you choose to do it, does focus on the research that was pointed out is vital to collect the data, to understand the problems, to see what some of the ways of adaptation might be. I think your role might also be one of coordinating the best practices that people come up with, because my solution to a problem in this arena of climate change might be the same thing that would help some other industry. And I think we can't do this without setting the standards and challenging standards, not easy to meet, but setting standards that are challenging us without being prohibitively difficult. Basically, underlining the request to put us all to work to do the job that we're all doing ourselves, but probably with some coordination could do a better job of.
Thank you.
Stone, do you have anything to add?
No, Mr. Chair, I'll
Representative Whitsitt, please.
As a geologist by education and profession, we do have geologic precedents for the thinning of invertebrate shells, basically, in our nearshore ocean conditions throughout the Paleozoic time period. And it's something that I studied in my master's program at Oregon State. I think Oregon State has done a very good job
with the studies that they've done. The thing that I'm concerned about is that man didn't exist during the cyclical times that we had the thinning of these shells. We had extinction of more species than presently exist right now, most of which were invertebrates. So I don't know that there is an answer to what we're experiencing. I think it is natural. I do not think it's anthropogenically caused. And, I mean, we have evidence of this occurring in the past. It does not make it easier to accept now, but I think that sometimes we look for an explanation that we may not necessarily understand. And I think your idea that the oceans may be driving the climate may have some validity to it, and I tend to think that it's sun caused more than man caused. So
we'll take that as a comment. Thank you.
It is. Yeah. It is. Yeah. Thanks.
Representative Denbrough, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Jeff, I'm very intrigued by the climate-friendly nurseries project, and I'm wondering to what extent, and this might apply to the others as well, you see that the efforts in this respect can become part of the Oregon brand in terms of, you know, marketing to people who are really interested in dealing with this issue. Is there potentially a benefit that you can see from this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Denbrough, we believe so. We also participate in a certification program with the Food Alliance. Talk about having the Food Alliance and nurseries in the same room trying to have them tell us how our production methods can be certified third party. That was an interesting exercise, but we actually were able to complete it. It is, we have not seen, because of the economic downturn, we actually did this during the worst time of our economic cycle that this industry's ever faced. We knew we had to innovate. We saw these as potential problems, and we said no better time now to look at changes in our production than the current time. We do believe that the Oregon brand is already significant. I think it can be added to show that it's more sustainably done.
Okay. Thank you all for your testimony. We thank very you. Much appreciate your time, and thank you for making the trip to come here. And we are now going to hang up the phone. Thank you, Mr. Peterson, Edry, for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for your long
time.
All right. And with that, close the informational meeting on impacts of climate change in Oregon. Open an informational meeting on impacts of Oregon's clean energy economy. I'd like to call up Werner Seaman, Mike MacArthur, and Judge Terry Tallman, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mike MacArthur, Association of Counties. Thank you for the opportunity to come here and talk about the impacts of renewable energy on Oregon counties and in Oregon's, particularly eastern Oregon counties. I'm here speaking on behalf of counties. Generally, AOC is very supportive of the activities around renewable energy for counties. We support the Community Renewable Energy Association and the Southern Oregon Clean Energy Alliance, among other things. But I'd like to turn first to Judge Terry Tallman from Morrow County, if you'd like, and to talk some about some of the specifics of the impact of renewable energy in his area, and then I can speak specifically about some of the things that happened in Sherman County. I know that some of you heard some of this yesterday, but we'll try and tailor this message to, I think, look into the future as well.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mike. And Mr. Chair, Chairman Bailey, and members of the committee, my name is Terry Tallman. I'm Morrow County judge, held this position since 1999. I am a juvenile judge, meaning that I also hear delinquency cases, but also DHS cases that involve mostly what it is removal of children from the home. I have about 50 active cases open right at the present time in our county, and although these payments that we're talking about, and I think we've provided you with a spreadsheet here that we're using mainly at the present time as a strategic planning effort for the county about what are we going to do with this funding and impact it in a way that when we get to the end of the 15-year period, where did those funds go? And so we don't come down to the point where we say, well, we didn't actually accomplish anything with these. So one of my goals is when we get done here, we want to see, turn around and be able to point to things that we can objectively say, we accomplished this, 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 and this. And so that's part of the spreadsheet idea. I used things like this in agriculture. My background is agriculture. I grew up in Malheur County. I've moved to Morrill County in 1978. I've been a resident of Oregon all my life, and I believe there are tremendous opportunities in agriculture. You heard the testimony of the gentleman ahead of us, and there are large areas that there's a great agreement there. One of the things that we do in Morrill County is we do give $100,000 a year, roughly, it's a little less, but $95,000 to OSU research in Umatilla County at the Hermiston Research Station. And we're studying things right now. One of the things that we've got going on in Morrill County is we do have unmanned aircraft flying because of the Department of Defense and U.S. Navy. But agriculture has snagged onto that, and they're using unmanned aircraft to monitor the agricultural fields of our two counties, where we're looking for bugs, like he was mentioned, where we're looking for places where there are diseases, and then what is it that we can do in an almost instantaneous manner to overcome those problems, even to the point that we're getting a center pivot. I don't know if you're familiar with center pivot irrigation, but center pivot irrigation is coming to the point that we are able to program certain portions of that, and we can make the outer end of the center pivot produce put more water on or certain things like that and including chemicals, if that's what's called for, so that we can tailor our water use to what is actually going on in the field. And the monitoring, then, like I'm talking about, this unmanned aircraft is a huge factor in that, because we can have a scan done of the field that morning and probably have the results by that afternoon and possibly be applying the chemicals by that day, solving those problems. So instead of waiting 3 or 4 days, which was often the way it was in the past, we don't have to do that anymore. But that's the research part of what we're looking at. And so we're very much in favor of whatever research that can be done, because things that they learn that he was talking about actually sometimes do have application to us. So we're very interested in what other fields of research are taking place, and it does have impact to us. Now, getting back to this very quickly, I'll just say there are things here as a juvenile judge in the social services area, and the biggest area that we have the difficulties in is actually in the use of amphetamine drugs and other things like that. Huge, huge problem. And, you know, once it grabs a hold of an individual, I mean, we're looking at a lifetime struggle here. Just in the last 2 weeks alone, I had mothers. One, the baby was born, well, we're not totally sure. We hear one story that was born in the back seat of a car, and it was some 13 hours before the child got to the hospital. The last one that I had just Monday, the child was 3 days old. These mothers, here's a little baby, just, you know, all it can do is cry, and somebody has to take care of it. When we, although we don't have money that goes directly to this, one of the things that we're talking about here is human services that needed to be developed, first of all, to take care of the child. Second of all, to see if there's anything that we can do to help the mother or the family. If there's, and what we find in those some of the worst cases, we don't even know who the father actually is. She doesn't know who the father is. And one's got 5 kids and one's got 6. And, I mean, that leads to a whole bunch of other questions, you know. So, I mean, human services end up being involved in this as well. One of the last things, I'll just stop here. This has also enabled us, we've had to take some money. One of the things at a very personal level, and I mean personal by the citizens of Morrill County. We have a 100-year-old courthouse. This 100-year-old courthouse has a clock dome on it. This clock dome has been leaking. And when they installed the original tin on the dome up there, it didn't really get installed 100%. It wasn't until last year that we realized there was a major problem. With some of this money, we're going to be able to fix that clock dome and restore, and it's a National Historic Building, so we've got requirements there, yeah, I'm sure you're all familiar with. But our original estimate on the deal from an engineer was $500,000 to do that. We didn't have $500,000. So through a series of other events, we're probably down to, we're going to get it done, we got it off, and we're going to get it back on probably here sometime in October. And we're going to try to restore it back to some of its original state as well. We're actually going to put the clockworks down where it can actually be observed, and we're going to take the electric motor out, and we're going to put the weight system back in. We'll have to wind it up once a week, but we're going to put the weight system back in so it'll be observable by the citizens of our county. And the folks that are the 100-year-olders in our county are very pleased that we're going to do that and not just junk it and throw it off. So those are all instances, agriculture, personal services, and then just buildings, that these dollars end up impacting us in a very, very favorable way.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, Chairman Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm the policy director for Renewable Northwest Project, and thank you very much for your time this morning. This is actually the third hearing this week that's talked about renewable energy in the state of Oregon and talked about the RPS. This is the first that's actually had a chance to kind of coalesce around the impacts and the positive benefits that we've seen from renewable policy that the state of Oregon has adopted over the years. To summarize and add in addition to what Judge Tallman just talked about for his county and giving the specific examples and some of the things that he sees in terms of services that they're able to provide and needs they're able to meet in his county as a result of some of the tax revenue provided by, and largely in particular, one wind project, the Shepherd's Flat wind project. What we've... Pardon?
All three
of those separate projects. Yes, yes sir. What we've heard in testimony this week is from the Oregon PUC that the result on rates for ratepayers in the state of Oregon from the renewable portfolio standard is less than 1% of a rate increase by having the RPS in place. Less than 1% of a rate increase. What we've seen in terms of the economic benefits to counties is that we've seen over $9 billion, it's billion with a B, invested in counties throughout the state of Oregon, and actually not quite throughout the state of Oregon, largely in the rural and eastern parts of the state, which have been, I think, some of the most economically hard hit during the recent recession. That investment, that $9 billion, has been thousands of construction jobs, hundreds of ongoing operations and maintenance jobs. When we talk to the folks in those counties that have seen this investment occur as a result of the policies that the state of Oregon has adopted, we've seen improved infrastructure, investment in deferred maintenance. In talking with Judge Tallman, Judge Schaefer in recent weeks, we're talking about improving sewer systems, which are in some cases 80 and 90 year old pipes, which are collapsing. We're seeing improved investment in roads. We're seeing the ability to reinvest in social services. We see libraries being built. We see schools being improved. We see tracks being built so that people have a safe place to run so they don't have to run on the road with traffic. What we also hear when we talk about, and I think outside of the renewable portfolio standard, but an ongoing conversation for folks in the state and thinking about folks like the people who live in Representative Bent's district, is we've seen a very difficult time in the state of Oregon with a lack of investment and a lack of opportunity in rural Oregon. And I think that what we can say at this point from what we've seen, in addition to there was a early earlier this spring, an Employment Department report that the state of Oregon put out that during the most recent few years, during the recession, during the downturn, the only counties in the state of Oregon that added jobs and had a net increase in employment were those counties in the northeastern part of the state that had investment in renewable energy as well as investment in call centers and also some job creation from some of the aircraft manufacturing that occurs across the river in Washington. So I think that as we have the conversation about what are we doing for rural Oregon, what are we doing for job creation in the state, what are we doing for economic development, I think that we should say that the renewable portfolio standard is a very strong policy for the state, and it's largely successful in terms of meeting these policy goals that the state has. Thank you.
So now I'd like to turn to specifics here. I'm also the former Sherman County judge. This picture on the slide is from behind my house, a hill behind my house looking east from in Sherman County. That's the western front of the Saudi Arabia of wind in Oregon, Sherman, Gillam, and Morrow County. I don't know exactly how many megawatts. I think they're approaching 6,000 megawatts through the, through those counties. This has all happened in about the last 14 years, and it was made possible by a number of factors, and as Varner said, the RPS was a huge one. The Betsy was a huge factor in making that possible. The federal production tax credit was really important. BPA's ability to integrate and have the transmission capacity was a key factor, and the California market. And frankly, most of those are gone now, and I'm real concerned about what next. In Sherman County, it's meant a tremendous change in the ability of the county to do things. As I said yesterday, our assessed value, total assessed value when I was county judge there in 2002 or 3, was $200 million. Whole county is worth $200 million by maximum assessed value. It's now $2 billion. So if you take the permanent rate for schools, just for schools, and apply that to the $2 billion, look at the return on investment. And that's what the Betsy helped do. And I don't know that we've looked enough at the return on investment from those dollars that Senator Burdick is so worried about not going to schools. Do come back to schools through this investment. Sherman County has done a lot of great things with the money that's come to them with the SIP. Each household in the county gets a check for $599 a year. So those who don't benefit from the leases on the land, who get to look at that, do get a check for $599 just for living in the county. They've given $100,000. They give $100,000 to every city in the county every year for whatever they want. They've given a tremendous amount of money to the schools for infrastructure, for programs, for facilities. We're building a new K through 6 schools there in Sherman County soon. A $2.5 million library for 1,800 people. Those kinds of things have happened in Sherman County. But it's a limited time frame. These SIP agreements that brought the money and the additional property taxes are limited to 15 years, and we're halfway through in Sherman County, halfway through some of those programs, and we're still losing population. You know, I say, my joke is, I taught my son how to drive tractor and combine. He went to Eugene, never came back, and now he's an urban planner. So I think anybody who heard Mark McMullen talking Monday about the problems of rural areas, you know, we're raising kids in rural areas to come to the city and work, and there's nobody to replace them. And that's what Sherman County's trying hard to try and find, put together in place programs that will help keep people in the community. The wind farms have helped keep some families there. They've brought some kids with abilities who have like technical computer people been able to move back to the county to take some of those jobs, limited number of jobs that are there. But I don't know that there's going to be much of a future for this type of development in Oregon, given the cheap natural gas prices, the unwillingness of us to continue the Betsy program at the previous levels. And I just don't think that we heard PGE and Pacific Core say they've met their 2020 goals on the RPS. They're there. The last project PGE bought is in Washington because they, I don't know why exactly, but the incentives were better there. So where's the opportunity in the future? I maintain that where the opportunity is in small-scale renewable energy. And we have a goal, it's not a law, but it's a goal in the RPS that 8% of our renewable energy come from small-scale community-based renewable energy. We learned long ago in Sherman that the real benefits to these type of projects come to the owners of the project, be it the shareholders, the PGE, or the folks who invest in Caithness or Iberdrola. That's where the real profits are. So why can't we own these sources of renewable energy in Oregon? Well, we can. And it's a program called the Public Utility Policy Act, passed in the 1970s, that exists now. The PUC implements that program and adopts the rules. Right now, there's an investigation going on at PUC, UM1610, that's really going to determine the future of whether we have small-scale, community-owned renewable energy or not. And what the PURPA does is it requires the investor-owned utilities to buy the power from the renewable producer at the avoided cost. So the question is kind of is, what is the avoided cost? Is it the actual price of natural gas is on the market today, or is it the price of other renewables? So I think there may be an opportunity for the legislature to step in here and foster policies that help generate further development of small-scale community renewable, whether that's wind, whether that's solar, whether that's in-the-pipe hydro, whether it's geothermal. I think that's really distributed generation is where the opportunity is, and I think small-scale renewables is where we own the means of production, where folks in Oregon own those means of production, not a shareholder in New York. I think that's where we have to look. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm all in favor of doing something for our rural counties, obviously. I was just checking here because one of the questions that I tried to ask earlier was whether we should be spending our time adapting or spending and money adapting or spending our time trying to reverse the situation that leads us to today. So when I look at those wind towers, I go, okay, well, that's great for the investment in Morrow County, but in a way, it's a reflection of the fact that we haven't been allowed to do other things. And so we are so desperate that we are okay with this type of investment. In fact, we encourage it. We welcome it. We're desperate. That's the truth of it. But getting back to climate, the issue is, should we be spending our money in this fashion? Or because this is an attempt to generate green power, which avoids carbon, the theory being that we need to reduce carbon because we'll make our condition better. But 5 minutes on the computer shows us that the condition of our oceans cannot be reversed for thousands of years. And we're already there. So shouldn't we be spending our money on adapting as opposed to trying to reverse what appears to be an irreversible situation? And again, I want to make it really clear. I'm all in favor of investing in rural Oregon. I spend all my time trying to figure out how to do it. But today we're talking about climate. So let's move away. I know your job is to try to show us what good things are happening as a result of this. But the three of you, tell me, is this a wise investment? Should we have better spend our money, as we heard earlier, putting more money into Oregon State to help us adapt to what appears to be the inevitable?
Chairman Bailey, Representative Benz, I'm going to use a highly advanced scientific analysis and say when in a hole and you're digging yourself deeper in a hole, stop digging. I think that before answering the question of do we adapt or do we try to reverse, I think one of the questions is what are we doing right now to turn the lights on today in Oregon, and what is that doing to the amount of carbon that we're emitting? And the truth is, today in Oregon, about a third of our electricity comes from coal power generation. The way that the grid operates is, at all times, in real time, the amount of power we're putting onto the grid has to be equal to the amount of power we're taking off of the grid. And I think that one of the questions that we think about in the electrical sector, and which I realize doesn't get to your question exactly, is how do we reduce the amount of emissions that we cause in the state of Oregon by engaging in the commerce and the recreation and the daily living that we do. And what we see is that there is the opportunity to both make these investments as well as to quit using as much, largely Montana and Wyoming coal, because that's where the bulk of our coal power comes from. We're going to retire the Boardman facility in Oregon. We won't have any coal generation taking place in the state of Oregon. But on a going forward basis, we're still going to be using, unless we make different policy decisions, we're still going to be using a significant amount of coal power generation, which exacerbates the problem. So I guess and I'm not an expert in terms of the climate science, but as we continue to have the emissions, we see problems like ocean acidification getting worse. So I'm not sure if we should be spending the money in terms of trying to reverse or trying to adapt, but I think that if we don't expand the amount of renewable energy and low carbon energy that we use, we're going to continue to cause emissions, and the parts per million of carbon in the environment are going to continue to grow.
Please.
Yes, Chairman Bailey, Representative Vance. Just let me say in that respect and what's being talked about here in your question, I don't know that I've got a real good answer in terms of saying, yes, we should be investing here, or no, we should not. I don't think there's a real good, easy answer there. But what I can say is that with the fact that in Morrow County we're going to lose the coal plant. The coal plant's been there since the 1970s when I first moved there. That coal plant provides 130 jobs, top-paying jobs, as well as 400 contractors, also top-paying jobs, that have been there. And what's interesting about it, roughly half of those jobs, actually, the people live in Umatilla County. Now, I say that the reason that Hermiston has grown, and it's the largest city in basically eastern Oregon now, is because Morrow County has provided jobs. And what we found at the Port of Morrow, that probably about 50% of those people that live there, that work there, actually live somewhere other than Morrow County. So we've got a small problem we're trying to work on there. Getting back to your thing, your question, Representative Pence, we're looking at, we're anticipating that the plant's going to be closed down. We went through a big, long battle with DEQ and then ultimately with PUC, and we're just about at the point where some of the answers are probably going to be presented to us here, a potential answer with another gas-fired plant there. In line with that, what PGE is saying is that they don't want to shut down the coal plant completely and just do away with all that infrastructure, which I understand. I mean, infrastructure is hard to come by. And it was something that's being renewed every year. They have an outage during when we have the high power produced elsewhere. They take their outage and they refurbish that almost every year. I think part of the answer is in the research area. Again, getting back to some of the previous people, if we aren't doing some research, and it may not be just in the ocean area, but if we aren't doing some kind of research and funding some kind of research, and Morrow County is fully on board with what PGE is trying to do, we're looking at three or four possibilities of biomass projects that may be able to use the PGE coal plant and its infrastructure that's already there, and do a biomass thing that would run the plant not so much on a year-round basis as it is now, but maybe run it on a six-month basis. And so we're looking at three or four sources of biomass, and PGE is investing a huge amount of money at this time, which we're supporting, which may end up being biomass that we actually grow in our county or in Umatilla County, or possibly, as much as I hate to say it, it's across the river, maybe in Washington, but something that's close by that would, because of the research that's going on and all the learning that we're doing with this, that might come around and do some positive things to what you're talking to solve the problem that you are. It isn't a real yes or a no, which I think that's what you're saying, but I think that we've got to, I think it's a part of the adaptive process that we're looking at here, and hopefully that we come up with some answers soon that will have impact in other areas. And just like the gentleman here that was sitting in Mike's seat before, he says, we find out, and the other gentleman, we find out when we start the learning process, we get answers that we may not have expected. We get answers that sometimes we don't like, but we find out that there are answers that in the long run end up solving some of the problems that we really first started to answer. So it's a long, hard road. Yes, it costs money, and yes, it takes time. And I think with Representative Whitsitt and some of the things that she said there, we're looking at things that very possibly could actually be beyond our control, and that's not something I like to say, but I think we might be looking at some of those things. So we've got to come up with incremental ways that we solve those problems, and hopefully then that whatever we're doing, we're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, sort of thing, that idea.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, I think we can do both. We heard that the utilities say that the incremental cost to the ratepayer of adopting the 2015 at least goals were less than 1% cost increase. So I think we can invest in renewable energy, and we can make plans that help protect the climate as well.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we could probably talk about this for hours. And
yes.
I just wanted to say that Representative Bence does produce a real charge, and it's being addressed in a lot of different areas. I know that PennWER, the organization of five states, five provinces in Canada and territories, has made ocean acidification one of their top priorities for discussion coming up in November with their new chair, Senator Ranker, from lives in the, what's it called, Island County or something, whatever, in Washington State. Very ocean-oriented, and he's very ocean-oriented. So that, I think that discussion is going to be happening anyway, and Mike, you brought up small projects, and that's kind of where my focus has been for the same reasons. And one of my bottom lines is, you know, emergency preparedness, and the top recommendation for the resilience plan came out of all eight sectors who studied it was energy systems up. And, you know, we're going to be cut off at the coast. That's kind of a given. As you go further east in the state, that's where people will be moving. And this is all, you know, the doom and gloom when the big one hits. But in our case, where I live and along the coast and in the valley area, I think small projects, more concentric into the area and how they're going to be used, so that their direct drive stuff, I mean, it gets all over the place. We're having a wave energy conference next week in Astoria. There'll be device developers from all over the world coming. Where it's really booming is in the tidal areas and small projects. And so, I mean, and Judge Tallman, you brought up the cost. I was taking notes on what you were saying and trying to develop the nexus that you were hitting at, and you're spot on. So thank you. Thanks, all of you. Varner, you're young. That's good. We want you in this for a long time.
Representative Reardon.
I think this question would be for Mr. Seaman, but could you talk just a little bit about the potential for renewables and how much growth over what period of time, and understanding that we need that, you know, that base power such as Boardman provides, but what really is the opportunity? Is it, you know, we're shooting for kind of 25% maybe, but is it 50 or?
Chairman Bailey, members of the committee, it's an excellent question. There are a couple different ways you can think about it. What the utilities have talked about is for the 25% by 2025 targets that we have, they're on track towards meeting those. Those are the statutory requirements for the investor-owned utilities that serve about two-thirds of the customers in the state. They're on track to meet that at pretty low cost, and it's turning out to be not that much of a stretch to be able to reach that level of renewable energy development. What I would note is about 43% of the electricity we use in the state of Oregon is hydropower currently, which provides a very, you know, a zero carbon base for the system, which is a fantastic resource for integrating renewable energy. It has some pretty fantastic operating attributes for it. So as we talk about moving forward in the state with combination of our existing base of hydropower, adding renewable energy, wind, solar, geothermal, tidal power, biomass energy. I think that it is entirely feasible for us to be thinking about not too distant in the future that we could have a portfolio of a diverse set of energy resources where 100% of our electricity needs are met from zero carbon resources. I think that as we talk about natural gas in the near term, it's very inexpensive now, but what we've seen historically is it's a highly variable commodity. Most commodities do have price fluctuations that exist within it. It's worth noting that in the last 12 months, if you look at Henry Hub, which is sort of a benchmark trading hub for natural gas, we've had over 100% increase on the MMBTU price for natural gas, which as I look at, I mean, Chairman Bailey probably has better understanding of how you define variability within a commodity price, but as I look at that, there still remains significant amount of price variability and some risk to rate payers with that. But I think that it is possible to look at, especially here in the Northwest, that we could move to a zero carbon electrical grid as we move forward. And I think that what we're seeing in other parts of the country, in California, there's a robust conversation about moving to a 50% renewable portfolio standard. I think that some pretty significant investment is and shift in the way that we produce electricity is possible in the next decade or two. I'm not sure if that answers the question, sir.
Perfectly. Thank you.
Could I just add?
Oh, sorry, please.
Chairman Bailey and members of the committee, Representative Reardon, one of the things that is going on in our county, we are having interest still in some wind potential. We actually have notice of intent. I think I mentioned this yesterday. Notice of intent documents that indicate that there are some smaller companies that are interested in doing something with wind in our county. So I think that there's going to be people that will go as far as they can go, take it, and some have indicated to me that they won't need the Betsy. And they won't need, you know, whatever else. They're probably going to use a production tax credit as long as that stays around. But, you know, you can take that any direction you like. I'm interested in seeing if there aren't some people, though, who would like to invest further in wind production in Morrill County and probably still in Gillam or whatever. At the same time, Morrill County is also a member of the CREA group. And so we are having some good, and it's a Community Renewable Energy Association, the thing that Mike's talking about. We believe, and again, it gets back to what Mike originally said, we believe that the real answer is at more or less the individual level. And so that's why it's important to us that we have, again, I think there's another generation of some kind of turbine production or whatever that might be out there that fits into the theme that we've been talking about here. Let's get some of the best minds of our universities and let's develop that thing. Let's develop that thing here in the United States. We'll build a plant in Morrill County and we'll make it work, you know. And so give us the opportunity. We'll run with it. Invest some dollars. Do some research. All the things that we've been talking about. And so I think there's great opportunity out there. It's part of it is just our own will. Do we want to do that? And it gets back to the question, where are our priorities that Representative Bentz is talking about? Do we invest the money here? Do we invest the money there? And that's going to be, you know, to some people, that'll probably be a pretty good fight. But it is also a part of life. So I hope that might add a little bit of thought to it.
Representative Whitson.
Yes, I'm very happy to hear that some of the counties are benefiting from the RPS standard. I would just bring Klamath County as an example of our electric rates in Klamath County have increased in the middle double digits in the last 8 years. And this profoundly affects our senior citizens, those on limited incomes, and agriculture. And I know that we have farms surrounding where my husband and I live, whose electric bills to pump their irrigation water on well-established ranches are between $100,000 and $200,000 for a three-month time period now. And so we're seeing agriculture being driven out of certain parts of the state because of the cost, and we are being told that these increases are due to the RPS. primarily, and it's Pacific Core, who they have a lot of coal plants, and so they're having to convert. And so I think you're seeing an inequitable distribution of some people are paying for more for the RPS than other people are, essentially. And so, you know, when we see a 40% increase in our electric rates in just a few years, and we're hearing that that's one of the major cost drivers, I don't know that it's the full amount or anything like that, but we hear that. I mean, that's a concern for the people who don't have a lot of money for their monthly bills and for agriculture. So, I mean, we just need to keep in mind that this is not equal around the state, that some of us are paying more than others are in our increased rates to meet the standard.
Thanks. Representative Boone?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, in light of the discussion on small projects and community infrastructure investments, there's a model in Nova Scotia and tiny little Briar Island, and it's a community fund that the people, you know, instead of buying stocks, you buy shares in the fund, and the fund has to be 51% locally owned, and the money only goes to fund, for, in their case, energy infrastructure projects and maintenance. And so people keeping their own money in their own community, producing their own energy, so that it stays, and it's all small projects.
Yes.
And it really is very successful.
Very interesting. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. We
really
appreciate
do appreciate
it.
The opportunity to speak.
Thank you.
And this is a great discussion that, you know, we're going to have over the next how many years, I don't know, but several.
We look forward to engaging in it. Thank
yep.
you. Okay, I'd like to call up our next panel. Slight topic switch here. I'd like to call up Jan Michael Barlow, Derek Smith, and Robert Hammerly, please. From renewable energy to energy efficiency. And whoever would like to start may start.
I may. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Derek Smith. I am CEO of Clean Energy Works Oregon, and I'm proud to reside in Representative Dimbrough's district. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. As Chair Bailey indicated, my colleagues and I are here to talk about the economic opportunity of energy efficiency. Clean Energy Works is a nonprofit public-private partnership. Our mission is to create jobs and reduce energy waste through the facilitation of home energy retrofits. We coordinate and deploy public-private and utility dollars to scale up the residential energy efficiency sector. We were founded 4 years ago as a pilot project seeded with Recovery Act dollars, and I'm here to report that this smart public investment is proving that residential energy efficiency can create quality jobs and unlock private capital to grow a vibrant marketplace. To date, our statistics include 10,000 signups, and what that means is that over 10,000 homes across our state have been evaluated for energy efficiency potential. 3,200 of those homes have been upgraded for energy efficiency in rural, suburban, and urban communities in nearly all of your districts. Each of those homes is saving an average of about 30% in terms of energy use, and that has resulted in more than $1 million put back into the pocketbooks of Oregonians instead of being spent on energy waste. As for jobs, we know that through our work, for every 10 homes upgraded, one job gets created, for example, Jan's job. To date, we have enabled 1,300 workers to receive paychecks, 377 new hires in the hard-hit construction industry, $21 an hour average wages across multiple trades from weatherization to plumbing to electrical to HVAC, 56% of work hours performed by women and people of color, 36 veterans working on projects, and $62 million in economic development, and all these numbers continue to increase. Before we began our work, this market was about only 200 homes per year were being deeply retrofit for energy efficiency, and workers were paid piece rate wages, averaging around $9 an hour. We are now lifting people out of poverty and into career pathway professions. How do we generate these numbers? It all comes down to making it easy for citizens to upgrade their homes for energy efficiency. The way it works for a homeowner is they sign up at our website. We arrange for an assessment of their home and pair them with a vetted contractor like Greensavers here. A scope of work is drafted and agreed upon by the contractor and the homeowner. We arrange financing from a local lender to keep those local dollars circulating in the community. And we provide quality control and customer service throughout the project. Currently, there are more than 200 contractors throughout Oregon that are growing their businesses in clean energy works, including 40 or so prime contractors like Robert Hammerly of Greensavers, who is here today and is one of our best. And multiple private lenders are providing unsubsidized financing. These lenders include several credit unions, a regional bank, a community development financial institution. Loan products include unsecured home equity and on bill, which means customers can pay back their loans on utility bills, which is a function of the EAST law that you all passed overwhelmingly in 2009 and that Chair Bailey championed. So private investment is happening, and it was spurred on by public investment. And as we look to our future, Clean Energy Works is moving beyond ARA and into a self-sufficient business model where we earn fees for the service we provide to homeowners, contractors, and lenders. And the state is providing follow-on investment. And I want to thank Governor Kitzhaber and the legislature for the appropriation and commitment of going forward funding for Clean Energy Works. And I thank you very much for your support today.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Good morning, Chair Bailey and the rest of the committee. Thank you for having me here. My name is Robert Hammerly. I'm the president and founder of Greensavers. We are a home performance contractor based in Bend, Oregon, and we also have an office in Portland. I founded the company in 2006 with just myself and a credit card, and now we have grown to approximately 20 employees. We have grown this company through some of the worst of the economic downturn, and a big factor in that growth has been the matched public investment that has come alongside with the private investment that we have done in our own organization. It is, you know, for us to contribute to the Oregon economy, and for us to continually invest in our organization, it is essential that we have an outlook, and there is a consistency to the public investment. And Clean Energy Works has really helped stimulate this industry that I'm talking about. The home performance industry is a new industry. I think the oldest home performance businesses out there originated around 2002-2003, so we are really just starting to get our head of steam. We're just starting to build the momentum. We're just starting to get the public awareness and the education out there that's necessary for us to really take off on the trajectory that we all want. But it has been because of Clean Energy Works and their unique recipe for helping this industry gain traction that we've been able to contribute to the economy like we have, and hopefully here going into the future they will be our partners moving forward.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and remainder of the committee. My name is Jan Michael Barlow. I currently work for a contractor named Sensible Energy Solutions out of Portland, Oregon, which is where I reside. I've been a part of the home performance field for the past 8 years now. I've seen all the different aspects of the work. I've been in the attics and the crawl spaces, and I've worked as an auditor and as a crew leader as well. My current position is a senior crew leader for that company, Sensible Energy Solutions. But I'm here today really to talk about the opportunities that have been given to me in this trade. It's an emerging trade, and in the public there really isn't a lot of talk about weatherization technicians or home performance technicians. And recently, with the support of Clean Energy Works, there's been able to an apprenticeship program developed specifically for weatherization technicians on a residential level, which I'm extremely proud to be the chair of. And with that being said, things are moving in an extremely positive direction with the support of Clean Energy Works. I wouldn't be able to have the paychecks coming in on a weekly basis that I get. I wouldn't have been able to be given the opportunities that I've been given without the support of programs like Clean Energy Works. It does work, and it works really well, and I extremely encourage all of you to keep on supporting that. For also my coworkers and friends that are in the industry, I know that they're relying on work like this as well, so I appreciate it, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Questions for this panel, Representative Dembrough.
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'd like, first of all, to follow up on the workforce issue. I'm very intrigued to hear of, the demographics of the people working in the industry now. And I'm wondering what, you mentioned, John Michael, the apprenticeship, and I'm wondering what the pathway is into the industry and if there are some potential connections being made with career technical education programs in our high schools and, if you see a kind of pathway here for young people as well as people who've been out of work and dislocated workers coming into the industry.
Yeah. If I may, and Robert, maybe you can talk about your partnership with Portland Youth Build as well. But Mr. Chair, Representative Dembrough, thank you for the question. It's important, particularly as this industry has evolved over the past few years. We have formed many partnerships with pre-apprenticeship programs and organizations in the communities that we serve throughout the state. And the requirement that we have on contractors when they hire is that they also post through WorkSource, and that they so we're leveraging as much public investment on the workforce side as we can, and we also encourage that the new hires are sourced from the pre-apprenticeship program so that we can actively lift folks out of poverty and into professions, but not just for those entry level jobs, but that they also have career pathways that can move them along, and we have dedicated strategies to make that happen in partnership with the community organizations we work with and the public investment side, workforce intermediaries and those organizations. We absolutely think there's we have partnered with Portland Youth Build. We think there's more opportunities to engage younger folks in the trade as the trade evolves through the apprenticeship program that's now been established, and we intend to do that. I appreciate the question very much.
So currently, I think our makeup of staff, and especially on the install side, most of those employees have come out of the construction sector, and that, as I'm sure all you are aware, that sector was decimated. A lot of those people were out of work, so there were lots of people to hire and a abundant supply. Going forward, our organization, Greensavers, has made the investment in. We have partnered with Portland Youth Build as well as Central Oregon Builders Association to put on Green Jobs Day for youth, kind of exposing them to the industry and the idea that that this would be an area where youth could focus. And for us, it's a matter we have to, in a lot of trades, the workforce is graying, and there is this problem on the horizon that in the skilled trades we don't have the youth coming into that. So to do our part in that, we have done these Green Job Days to try to bring exposure to this industry.
Thanks. Mr. Paul.
Actually, this is a slightly different question, but since I have you here, I do want to ask, Derek, you know, at the end of the last session, we thought we had put a little more money into this sector, and then we ran into some constitutional issues with our governor, and so we're kind of... We're at a point where that can't go forward. What is, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to deal with that sometime in the near future, but what is the effect of the loss of those dollars in your operation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dimbrough, thank you for the question. We were grateful for the legislature's commitment of $9.8 million, which was 98% of our request. Over the biennium, that would create 5,000 projects and 500 jobs to go along with those homes that have been upgraded. While the governor vetoed $4.8 million of that $9.8 million because of the source of the funding, not because of the recipient, he also did commit to full funding and to working with you all to on a strategy to not only find that full funding, but to get short-term funding to help us continue to grow business, help Robert grow his business, and people like Jan to continue to work. The impact, if it's not found, if the replacement money is not found, is that the you know, Robert may have to lay off, and folks and Jan's colleagues may have to find other work. And in terms of our organization, it threatens our ability to move toward self-sufficiency. And what we had said to the legislature last time is that this would be a one-time ask because we have a business model that gets us to self-sufficiency. The public investment or the state's investment drives volume, those 5,000 homes that can be upgraded. And through that volume, we can capture some fees along the way and ultimately get to a break-even and have a self-sufficient business model. So it threatens our ability to do that. So there's both market disruption as well as impact on our organization. And, Robert, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Yeah, I would just, you know, like, I think like most business owners, if not all business owners, consistency and being able to have an outlook at least somewhat into the future is key for us to invest in our business and contribute to the economy. So consistency is huge for us, and if there were any lapses in services offered by Clean Energy Works, that's going to be a big negative impact. If you know, it could lead to layoffs, and if not layoffs, just not new hires. So either way you look at it, I think severe negative consequences.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out, I did meet with Derek this week too, and he was talking about the because I was interested in the fact that we need kind of an energy trust program for the rural areas that don't use those public purpose dollars. And so he was talking about what his program can bring to the rural areas. And I have two community colleges in my district, and they would both be very interested in programs that would maybe, and I know you mentioned that you already work with people who, when they're doing seismic upgrades, they would, you know, talk about energy upgrades too at the same time. And that's what we've been asking for in our seismic grant program for public buildings. And it would be great to be able to expand that program to other than public buildings too as needed, because especially in the rural areas, there are a lot of buildings that are very old and homes built that are very old and maybe could benefit from an energy upgrade, a seismic upgrade, you name it, especially along the coast. And so I was wondering if you could elaborate on that, if you are doing it, planning to, you know, Robert, because and Jan, you're in your work, if you guys have branched out into rural Oregon for the rest of us.
Chairman Bailey, Vice Chair Boone, So we do a decent amount of work in Central Oregon. I would say that is about 50% of our revenue. And of that, I don't know the precise breakdown, but there, you know, there is Bend and Redmond proper, and then there is also the outskirts or the outlying areas, and areas we service, areas that are not that are served by consumer-owned utilities, so CEC and Mid-State Electric, and those are both considered rural utilities, I think, at least by some measure. So that is a decent part of our business, and we would definitely be interested in expanding that.
And just a quick follow-up,
please.
Just to remind you all and the audience, but if you look at a map of Oregon and all the electric co-ops, they sort of make this whole space almost fill it completely in. So there's opportunity there.
Representative
Benz. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The challenge, of course, in these kinds of programs is figuring out the value we're getting for the dollars, state dollars invested, and the. So give us, I know you've gone through this because you would have had to have done so in your appearances before Ways and Means, but what is that value per house to the state? The measure would be, of course, to the person that's in it, a reduced utility bill. The measure to the state would be reduced needs to create new electrical generation facilities. As a group of us, we would like not to have to do that. But so my question is, if do you have the numbers that show how much the state in this type of investment puts into a house and what the value is that we get back? And use any measure you wish, or all of them.
Mm-hmm. Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, thank you for the question. The investment in each home averages between $12,000 to $14,000, depending on the upgrade. So these are these upgrades include insulation, air sealing, new furnace or heat pump, new hot water system. So the multiple trades are involved.
That's total investment in the home. That's not the public portion.
That is not the public investment. No, thank you. Thank you, Chair Bailey. The public investment is, you know, roughly around $1,000, I would say, alongside roughly $1,000 of utility investment, and then the rest being private. We've provided analysis to Chair Unger on another committee that showed the return to the state of a $10 million investment would be about 7x, I can't remember, I think 7.2x private investment in the community, and then also a return to the state in terms of tax and added tax revenue. Heck, I don't have those numbers off the top of my head, but I know other members of your colleagues have said this looks like one of the best returns on state investment they've seen. I'm happy to provide you more details.
Well, please. Right. I actually wasn't looking at it so much as a jobs as I was looking at it from an energy standpoint.
Okay.
And pushing the jobs over to the side.
Okay.
We invest the 14, or I'm sorry, a group invests the $14,000 in the house. There should be a reduction then in the amount of energy consumed. And that's what I'm kind of interested in, because that component of energy reduction is then what is used to kind of drive the rest of the process. But I'm just interested in knowing, for the dollars invested at the state level, how much energy is saved.
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, thank you for the question. So each home averages about 30% energy savings. We've analyzed the actual usage a year after the retrofit was done, and it does bear out that what was modeled to happen is happening in these homes, and one reason for that is that we use quality contractors like Green Savers, who go in and they do good work. We vet them to make sure that citizens get the return that they should get. And because workers are trained, like Jan, other programs, other contractors don't focus on the quality of the work as much as we do. Am I getting to the heart of your question? I want to make sure I'm doing it.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Please. So if the monthly utility bill was $150,
right.
it now drops to $100.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so it's $50 savings. I don't know how many kilowatts that is. But the state's investment prompts a reduction in energy usage of a third. I'm just trying to see what it's costing the state per kilowatt hour saved. And I don't want to look at it as a jobs bill for the moment.
Okay.
It's all kinds of jobs bills. I'm just interested in the energy part of it.
I appreciate the question. I don't have the number off the top of my head. I'm happy to get back to you on that.
Thank you.
And I would imagine that the answer to that ties into the fact that there are rigorous cost-effectiveness tests for dollars put in on the utility portion of the dollars that you're working with as you partner with those kinds of entities that are making the investment. There is that cost-effectiveness look in parts of the money of the programs that you're operating.
Chair Bailey, yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Thanks for
making the trip. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're a little bit behind schedule, but it's been a great discussion, so we've still got some time. Close the informational meeting on impacts of Oregon's clean energy economy. Open an informational meeting on Oregon's Global Warming Commission biennial report.
Jules, can I say something just briefly? I just want to clarify something that I
sure.
for the record.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that the increase is a percentage increase in the bills for specific core. So
it
wasn't the rates that were in double digits, it was a percentage that so
got
you know,
it. Thank
okay.
you.
I just want to clarify that for the record there. So.
Thanks for the clarification. All right. Mr. Duncan.
Mr. Chairman.
Kick us off.
Members of the committee, nice to see you all again. My name is Angus Duncan. I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation. We work in renewable energy and watershed restoration, mostly in the rural Pacific Northwest, mostly in consumer-owned territory, actually. And with me today is one of the members of the commission, Alan Zelenka, who is, if I get this right, Alan, Energy Services Director for Kennedy Jenks Consulting in Eugene. A member of the Eugene City Council and also someone who has an extensive job history in the electric utility industry, in the public power. And Bill Drumheller from the Oregon Department of Energy, with whom I'm sure you're familiar, who staffs the Global Warming Commission. And we would like to bring you the required biennial report of the Oregon Global Warming Commission. I would like to preface my remarks by saying that I certainly agree that the Oregon legislature is not responsible for all the world's problems. But we do hold you responsible for solving them. And we're about to describe just, you know, what fun that's going to be. So, is it possible...
The screen's not going.
Power protection. To get the screen up so that we can do our fireworks. Great. Thank you. This is the Oregon Global Warming Commission. I put it up there so you can see the diversity of it. The voting members are from across the state and from a wide variety of occupations that are conversant with energy and climate change issues. The non-voting members are predominantly agency heads from state agencies. And I would just observe that both the roadmap to 2020, which we adopted in 2010, and this progress report have been agreed to unanimously by all of the commission members. And that's not necessarily an easy thing to do because there are some fairly challenging recommendations and some fairly, you know, critical observations in this report, particularly for a number of members of our commission. They cause a little, you know, professional or corporate discomfort. But folks all agreed that this was it is a good program and it is a fair progress report. I'm going to give you a physical description, if you will, or a graphic description of how we're doing. In 2003, when Governor Kulongowski set up his global warming advisory group, we had actually had state goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, or at least holding them stable since 1990, and the idea was we would hold them stable at 1990 levels. But we didn't have a program. We didn't have a set of recommendations or tasks. And, you know, with just a goal and no tasks, you get the inevitable result, and that's the upward creep that you see on the left-hand side of that, which we projected forward at the time to be approximately a 1 to 1.5% increase in emissions from the state of Oregon every year since 1990 and on out into the future. Governor Kulongowski said, that's not good enough. We can do better. The advisory group recommended the Oregon legislature adopted in 2007 some more specific goals. We said that by 2010, we wanted to have arrested that upward creep in the line. We wanted to have at least levelized it and, if possible, bent it downwards. By 2020, we wanted to be 10% below 1990 levels, which would have been about 30% below the levels in 2004-2005. So it's pretty challenging goal, and then by 2050 we wanted to be at least 75% below 1990 levels. So how have we done? Well, we actually haven't done bad. We hit our 2010 goal. We hit it for a number of reasons. The recession certainly was a part of it, but we really hit it before that recession hit, and we hit it through a combination of investments in energy efficiency, investments in renewable energy, reductions in vehicle miles traveled by automobiles, you know, some gains in the efficiency of automobiles, a number of other measures that were included in the recommendations in 2004 and again in 2010. The problem, of course, if you stop feeding this line, it bends back upwards almost immediately. So we have continued to feed it, and I just want to run through some of the recent measures that the legislature and others have engaged in. You've just heard about energy efficiency, and I would be happy to talk a little bit about both the capacity reductions and the dollar savings that we have captured from energy efficiency if there's time at the end of this. But energy efficiency moved the line downward by about that much. The Oregon Renewable Portfolio Standard, assuming that it is fully implemented, gets us another little bit of a wedge. That's the decision to close end coal burning at Boardman, Oregon's only coal plant, but most of our coal comes from Wyoming, Montana, and Utah. This is the coal plant in Oregon. A decision was made by the Portland General Electric Company, the CPUC, or the Oregon PUC, and the Oregon DEQ collectively, with the involvement of a number of stakeholders on all sides of the equation, that it was most cost-effective to the state to close that plant down and substitute for it, other resources which inevitably will be lower carbon emitting resources, either natural gas or renewables or some combination of those. And that's, we've assumed about half and half in calculating that line. That's the low carbon fuel standard, or the clean fuel standard, that the legislature considered earlier this year. Has not yet elected to extend it past its 2015 sunset date. If it is extended, it gets us another little piece of the wedge. If it is not extended, we give that one back up. So that is what we have done just in the last, 5, 6, 8 years, by way of making decisions that would change the trajectory of our greenhouse gas emissions line from the white dotted one to the red one. It certainly doesn't get us everywhere we need to go. That's where we need to go. But it is not immeasurable progress. It is significant progress. It is doable within the state of Oregon. It is doable particularly if we get some help from the federal government. If I can sort of reduce it to a bumper sticker, this would be the bumper sticker. About 50% of our greenhouse gas emissions in the state come from a combination of emissions from light-duty vehicles, cars and light trucks, and from coal plants that serve the state of Oregon. So that's 50% out of the total. And if we're going to make progress, we have to make progress particularly in those two areas. This is a somewhat broader characterization. So you can see that transportation is about a third of our problem. Electricity use is about a third of our problem overall, and then there are emissions that come from other parts of the sector as well. So if we're able to address light vehicles and reduce or ideally ramp out coal emissions altogether, we are two-thirds of our way to, or I'm sorry, we are halfway toward solving our greenhouse gas problems. And these two considerations are linked together, and it's probably useful to understand how that's the case. Electric vehicles are a major part of our transportation greenhouse gas strategy, the one that was developed by the State Department of Transportation over the last 3 years, accepted by the Oregon Transportation Commission earlier this year. We need to achieve somewhere between 50 and 90% penetration of our fleet by electric vehicles by 2050. That's a lot. Although I would add in passing that if we are able to do that, the actual cost per household for transportation for Oregonians goes down. We save money by converting from the current fleet to electric vehicles overall, and that includes both capital and operating costs. But it only gets us carbon savings depending on what the car is plugged into. If it is plugged into a socket in Eugene that's served by Eugene Water and Electric, it's going to get the gasoline equivalent of something above 100 miles per gallon. If it's plugged into Pacific Power, whose system looks a lot like Wichita, Kansas, it's going to get about 35 miles per gallon equivalent. If it's plugged into PGE, as we presently project PGE's resource mix, get about 55 miles to get to the gallon. So you get the carbon equivalent of a wide range of emissions reductions depending on the kind of electrical system you plug it into. So it's important for both cars and coal that we move forward on both of these together. I am going to shift, with your permission, to Mr. Zelenka and let him take the next set of slides. And I'll just run the button if you want.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Bailey and Vice Chair Boone, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. Thank you for having us here today. As Angus said, I'm Alan Zelenka. I'm the Director of Energy Services for Kenny Jenks and a member of the Global Warming Commission. As Angus mentioned, 50% of our emissions come from cars and coal. The good news is that we get a lot of help from the federal government and the actions that they can take to close that gap that we saw in that chart. The CAFE standards for increase in miles per gallon efficiency of vehicles and trucks will get us a long way there, as well as the Clean Air Act and the EPA power plant rulemaking to limit the CO2 emissions from power plants. And those are technology fixes that will help us get there, and they help us close that gap by about half or two-thirds. So that's the good news. But the rest means is up to us at the state level. So we still have a ways to go to get ourselves on the trajectory to the net, to that 2020-2050 line that we showed you. In your report that you have, plus the summary report, the report on page 7 and the summary report on page 3 is a scorecard. And the scorecard shows the 40 priority actions that come from the 2012 roadmap to 2020. So those recommendations are done by sector, and they also show a commission staff grades from A to D. And what you'll notice on there is that there's few A's and a few D's, mostly B's and C's, and overall the commission gives the state's actions towards meeting the legislative targets about a C-plus work. That means that we're gaining ground, but not fast enough.
So the 2012 roadmap actually had those six different sectors that we had. Each of those sectors had its own subcommittee that was, and I chaired the co-chaired the Transportation Land Use Subcommittee. And each of those subcommittees had about 10 to 20 experts that looked at all the different possible actions that were available or potential in that particular area, and then narrowed it down to the high priority items. Those then they're all summed up in this group of 40 high priority items. So these are the ones that we focus on. The 12 for the transportation and land use sector are seen here in this slide, and you can see that overall we get about a B minus in the transportation sector, doing a little bit better than the average overall. Some actions we made progress on, some we didn't. For instance, we get an A for keeping the urban footprints compact. And Portland and Eugene have held their urban growth boundaries pretty much over the last 20 years and are continuing to do that with little expansions to provide for growth. On the downside, where we didn't see much progress is the low-carbon fuel standard, where the removal of the 2015 sunset was an action that would, as you saw on the graph, lower our trajectory, but we haven't made that step yet. Each sector, if you looked in more detail, has kind of a mixed bag of grades of high-priority actions, but overall, it's C-plus work.
Okay. And I would like to emphasize that you know, we're grading ourselves. We're not grading agencies. We're not grading the legislature. We are grading the state of Oregon. These are you know, federal, state, local actions, and private sector actions, and all of them collectively end up contributing to our grade and to our progress or its lack of it. I want to apologize for the brevity of our presentation, but you'll be pleased to know that the full document is in your electronic inbox, and you'll want to take it home tonight and plow through it, I'm sure. Takeaways. So as Alan said, we're doing about C-plus work. We're doing better than a lot of states are doing. But our option, our alternative option to giving letter grades was to make this a pass-fail course. And if it were a pass-fail course, we'd be failing because A is passing. And that's the kind of work that we need to be doing across the board. To get to our 2020 goal, we've got to drop another 19% of our emissions between now and 2020. That's 7 years away. That's a very steep drop. We hope, as Alan said, we'll get significant help from the federal government, from the Clean Air Act enforcement of carbon dioxide standards, from the ramping up of automobile fuel efficiency standards, and from a number of other measures. Roughly speaking, probably two-thirds of that gap is going to be dependent on what the federal government does or doesn't do. But the other third is on us. And the kinds of things we can do are those that are uniquely state, local, or private. They're not the federal government's role. They're things like leveraging our land use laws to end up with more efficient urban forms, leveraging our building codes, the renewable portfolio standard, the kind of house-by-house, building-by-building energy efficiency work Clean Energy Works is doing. The investment in transit, in our transit agencies, in our metropolitan planning organizations, those are the things that the federal government can't do and that we need to. And the bottom line here, of course, is we need to focus in particularly on cars and coal. If we do, there will certainly be some costs, but there will be some significant savings as well. The Boardman decision alone is going to save PGE ratepayers about $450 million. That's the difference between retrofitting and continuing to run the Boardman plant in compliance with the Clean Air Act, or cutting the deal that we were able to cut collectively. Utility agencies, environmental stakeholders, customers, and others with EPA to cut that $500 million down to $50 million. There's big savings for PGE ratepayers. The energy efficiency we calculated some time ago saves the Pacific Northwest regionally, just in electricity alone, about
about $1.6 billion every year. It's probably, that's an old number, so it's probably more like $2 billion every year. The state of Oregon probably benefits from about a third of that. So it's a very significant savings in dollars. It's also a significant savings in reference to Representative Bent's question in energy and capacity that has to be generated. About 2,000 of the 6,000 megawatts of electrical capacity savings we have achieved over the last 30 years in this region go to the state of Oregon. So that's about 2,000 megawatts that we have not built to serve loads in the state of Oregon because of energy efficiency investments. You know, that comes to probably something on the order $750 million a year we are not spending because of our energy efficiency investments. We export about $8 billion a year from the state of Oregon to pay for diesel and gasoline. If we can reduce our consumption of those by having more efficient vehicles and driving them less, those are dollars that don't leave the state of Oregon. They stay here and generate jobs and income. So there are carbon benefits, but there are significant other benefits as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just checking. The USA, according to this, total emissions in 2011, about 6.7 billion metric tons of CO2 equivalent. Oregon's about 1% of that. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's about right. I was afraid someone would ask us a factual question. That's why I feel like
the question I asked earlier is one I've asked. I'm sure I've asked you, Angus, the question before, and that is how we best invest in our small little state so that we don't shoulder more of the obligation than we can afford to. I've been approaching this in many different ways over the years here, and working with Chair Bailey in trying to figure out how we can best spend our dollars. In your commission work, you must have prioritized how we best spend our money. And so can you share with us your thinking? Because the simplistic approach, which I adopt, is why don't we dump all the money into OSU or U of O or someplace, mm-hmm. and tell them to figure this thing out in a way that is broader in application than just little Oregon. And I'm all in favor of setting an example when we can afford it. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure I understand how you've prioritized your presentation and what you're suggesting that we do. So please share that with us.
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, it's always a great question, and my answer never quite measures up to it, but I will keep trying. So for openers, I don't think we propose that Oregon spend more than anybody else, but we do recognize that greenhouse gas emissions, you know, happen sort of one ton at a time or 1 pound at a time. You know, when you drive, you know, down the highway, and if you're driving an average fuel economy car, the carbon emissions are roughly equivalent to, you know, throwing a one pound bag of carbon out the window every mile. It's a lot of carbon, and it happens one mile, one car, one driver at a time. So we think that the responsibility for addressing this pollution has to be shared with all of the folks who have both the dollars and the authority at a multitude of different levels. It's why, for example, there's a slide in it that says we're relying on the federal government for significant changes in the way power plants and motor vehicle efficiencies are regulated, so that we can take advantage of those. We have a lot of things of authorities that we can exercise that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions at a low or no cost to the state government. And
and at costs to individual consumers that either are low cost or actual savings. And Mr. Drumheller managed a project that we did as a part of the governor's energy policy work that tried to identify from the cheapest measures to the most expensive ones what were the ones that we could start with that would be most cost effective, and we work our way up. So we're clearly almost all of the ones that are most cost effective are energy efficiency, and you've already heard testimony here about what kinds of savings the state realizes and the power system realizes if you make those investments, and those are the first ones that we make. It certainly becomes more problematic when you cross over to dealing with renewable energy projects and the question of whether those are cost effective or not. And you really, I think, have to look at that in a couple of different ways. One is, what's cost effective, today, narrow slice of time, when you're putting a wind turbine, which may produce $80 a megawatt hour power, up against an existing coal plant that's producing it at $30 or $40 a megawatt hour. Answer, clearly, that coal plant is cheaper short term. You also have to look at this long term and over an investment period. And if that wind plant is producing power at $80 a megawatt hour over the next 30 years, while the coal plant costs are going up, both as a function of fuel costs and as a function of regulation, then it may well be that wind project over its lifetime is more cost effective than the coal project over its lifetime. That's certainly true with new coal plants, and that's why no one's building any new coal plants. Tougher call with existing coal plants and gas plants, but the best, I think, illustration of this principle that I can direct your attention to is the kind of money that we spent developing the hydropower system in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s in this region. And if you go back and you look at a lot of the press coverage at the time, the clippings, they were full of expressions about how these were economic white elephants that would never pay themselves back. It was just money down the drain. You had to allocate the costs over multiple different purposes for the hydropower. Well, long story short, the Mid-Columbia PUDs who built the plants on the Mid-Columbia in the 1950s and paid a serious premium to build those renewable energy projects are now getting electricity from them at 1 to 1.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Way, way better than any gas or coal plant or wind turbine you see out there. So you have to look at these on a life cycle costing basis as well. I appreciate that you can't do everything on life cycle. You've got to also look at liquidity and cash flow. But I guess my observation, my response is we have to look at both cash flow and return on investment over time, and both the economics and the environmental returns say that we are going to be economically better off if we invest in more renewables and energy efficiency today, just as we were better off investing in hydro renewables back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s.
I'd just like to add to that, if I could, Chair Bailey.
That's the short answer, by the way.
Right. I agree that energy efficiency is the number one place to do the investments. It is the lowest cost resource that we have available to us. It increases the value of the assets of our homes and our businesses. It creates jobs, and it lowers people's operating costs. Everything else we can do in the energy arena, for instance, increases our costs, but this one actually lowers people's operating costs, puts them in a better footing from a business perspective. So energy efficiency is always as first. Reducing coal emissions and the low carbon fuel standards are the other things that are kind of big bang for the buck type measures. I think the way to look at this is that there is no silver bullet that will solve all of our will deal with this issue. It's more like silver buckshot. We have a lot of different things that add up to a significant change. And one of the things that Angus was mentioning was there's a thing called the McKenzie curve, which was done for the national government, but we had one done for Oregon, and it's a graph, and we can provide this to you guys to the committee. It's a graph that shows all the different actions that can be taken in the state of Oregon, from
lowest cost, the highest cost, and this line being whether or not it costs us or saves us. Most of these actions actually save Oregonians money and lower our cost, and most of those happen to be energy efficiency things. So those are the actions you do first. The last ones you do, and hopefully technology will increase them so they become more cost-effective, are the higher cost ones. So there's a lot of things that we can do now today that will actually save us money and put Oregonians in a better position.
And, Mr. Chairman, can I just extend the response a little bit to respond to a question that Representative Whitsitt raised earlier? And that's the question of the impact on the ratepayers in Klamath County, customers of Pacific Power, of Pacific Power's obligation to spend on renewable energy. I guess the first question is, I think that Pacific's math, you know, can use some severe scrutiny, because, you know, those kinds of costs, you know, cannot be attributed entirely to the renewable portfolio standard. But even leaving that aside, one of the maxims of electric utility planning, and Alan and I both have, you know, a lot of time invested in all of this, one of the maxims is have a diversity of resources. You may know what your costs are today. You're not going to know what they are 5 or 10 or 20 years from today, and the best insurance is to have a diverse set of resources, including fossil fuels, ideally gas rather than coal, but also renewable energy, some old, some new, energy efficiency. There are some new technologies that are available that can be developed in homes and businesses and are relatively small scale. Having that kind of diversity gives you insurance against future rate shocks, one of which is very likely to be a rate shock that Pacific Power is going to be facing, because 65% of the electricity it sends to Oregon comes from coal. Coal plants are being more heavily regulated under the Clean Air Act. The president intends to regulate them under the Clean Air Act for carbon dioxide emissions. There are some major league risks associated with putting all of your investment in a coal-denominated resource basket. And I think the safest thing for Klamath County ratepayers today and in the future is to insist that their utility have a diverse basket of resources serving their loads.
Representative Whitsitt was in the queue anyway, and I suspect might want to jump in on this point, so I'll go to you.
I agree with you, and I did want to clarify that the percentage was the percentage increase in Pacific Core. It wasn't the rate.
Right.
So I just want everybody to know, and I'm sure you knew that. But one of the things I'm very interested in, hydropower facilities that are off-stream, like pump storage, I think is huge for the future. Oregon has a lot of faults, and a lot of the displacement is over 2,000 feet. And so it seems to me like we could be using wind power to return the water up and generate electricity, from the fall of the water down. And so I was wondering, where are we at regarding pump storage for hydropower? Because that would be an ideal situation of clean and renewable and pretty inexpensive, because we keep reusing the source.
So that is a very good way to gain energy. What you do is you take energy during the off-peak periods where it's cheaper, and then pump the water up, and then during the peak time you let it drop and you generate electricity for it. And the trick is, use what's going to be the energy source of the pumping during the off-peak period in the middle of the night. Unfortunately, wind tends to not blow during the middle of the night. It blows during the peak time, so it has a marginal ability to do that. So if you're shifting from coal to natural gas to pump that storage, then you definitely see a decrease in greenhouse gas emissions. And eventually we'll get to the point, if gas stays where it is, natural gas stays where it is in terms of price, that becomes cost effective. But right now it's just outside the margin.
And more broadly, it's
it's important that, utilities in the future have not just increased resource diversity, but increased system flexibility. And flexibility really means adding to the storage capability of the system. Historically, we've been able to do that with the reservoirs behind the dams, and they've been an amazingly cost-effective way of managing, generation to load. We've run out of space there, so we're looking at storage. We're looking at compressed air in underground vaults. We're looking at demand response, water heaters that you can basically ramp up and down in your home. Never see a difference in the hot water, but it adds hugely to the flexibility of the system. So all of those things are on the list.
Okay.
Good question. Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I'm pretty sure I heard him say it the first time, but he said it twice, and he used the word renewable and hydro in the same sentence. So two-part question. When you might think that we could go that route and consider hydro renewable like the rest of the sane world does, and my opinion only. And then maybe looking into undersea wind storage through those, they're like giant ag bags underwater. Mm-hmm. But I think what Representative Whitsitt talked about was using the water twice mm-hmm. or more.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, well, there are at least two of us who regard hydro as renewable, and I suspect there are a lot more than two, and I may be one of the few witnesses you will see in front of you who has actually both developed hydro projects, which I have in the past, and is in a mode of developing a hydro project in collaboration with the city of Corvallis with its water system. So I've always regarded hydro as renewable, and I think so has the state. The distinction within the renewable portfolio standard is new resources versus existing. It's not hydro versus everybody else. So new hydro qualifies under the RPS just like any other renewable resource, and it absolutely should. But the point of the RPS, of course, is to increase system diversity by adding new renewables to the mix. And we think that, those are certainly hydro, wind, solar. We think, and this is at this point the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, because this is one of the things we do, we think that biomass, if we can figure out how to get around some of the really big disadvantages of hydro or of biomass, which are mostly that the stuff is all spread out and it's very low BTU and it's hard to collect and concentrate. If we can solve those problems, that biomass is certainly as significant a potential contributor to the electricity mix in Oregon as wind and solar. So we're hoping to do that. With respect to the undersea bags, I promise you we are looking at all different options, however obscure, however improbable, because we don't know which ones will work. I'm a member of the Regional Wind Integration Group, which was set up by BPA and most of the region's utilities to try to puzzle out how we shift the system from a baseload peaking system to one with a wide diversity of resources that produce collectively a much more flexibility than we have today. And energy storage, whether it's pump storage, whether it's bags under the ground, whether it's in your water heater, it is at a premium of becoming more so.
Yeah. Quick follow-up.
Very, very quickly, I have one more person in the queue, and then we actually need to move on to the next topic.
Oh, okay. You did mention,
Alan.
I forgot your name.
Yeah. Alan Zelenka.
Alan, thank you. About the cost of gas, and right now it's at the edge there because it's probably doubled in the last few years. But how do you suspect that exporting gas will affect the price for us? And is there like a tipping point where we can export some, keep the shareholders happy, but not all? And I'm talking about all of North America, which is Canada, U.S.
Mexico. You're talking natural gas, not gasoline, right?
Yes. But if we Where's that sweet spot where we can keep it, affordable here, but also benefit from the export piece too?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Boone, believe me, if I knew the answer to your question, I would be taking all my money out of my 401k and plopping it on gas futures. The truth is,
nobody really knows because it is unclear. Several things are unclear. One is the extent of accessible gas resources in this country using the new fracking and lateral drilling techniques and a whole series of other things. And secondly, we don't know what the world market for gas is going to look like, but it appears that the kinds of geologic formations we have that hold this previously inaccessible gas are not limited to the United States. So I would expect over the next 10 to 20 years that we will see the development of significant new supplies of natural gas in a lot of the places that otherwise would be the markets for compressed natural gas. And the cost of compressing it, shipping it, reconstituting it, and shipping it again, that I think is going to end up being kind of a natural gauge, if you will, on how much of this gas gets shipped overseas, given that there will be lots of other both producers and competitors. So I don't know the answer to your question, but I'm not too worried about it.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Boone, as a former power manager for an electric utility, my job was to forecast what was happening with natural gas prices, and that's how a lot of people lose their jobs, because it's extremely difficult to do, especially if it's about in the future. And the answer is, I concur, we just don't know. Price of natural gas used to be tied to the price of oil, but then oil skyrocketed, natural gas went down, so those linkages got broken up. It is related to supply and demand and what's happening within the United States, and as long as we keep adding more gas plants and increasing the demand and the supply, we'll see a reasonable escalation of gas prices for the foreseeable future, and gas prices will probably stay pretty low. Whether or not we can export enough of it to actually make any marginal difference on the commodity price of gas, natural gas, is probably doubtful, that we can't do enough of that to actually make any difference.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming today. So I've just been kind of scrolling through the whole report, and I can't wait to, curl up with a cup of tea and really dive into it. But I was looking at how you've broken down the information here according to, carbon emissions by sector, or looking at how we're doing that by sector. And I was looking at the only geographic distribution I could find were people's attitudes on climate change by geographic region, which is really interesting. But my question was looking at kind of our carbon output by geographic region in the state and trying to attack it possibly from that way, looking at some of the recommendations. On some of those are definitely more urban or rural. So could you talk a little bit about that, like where we're generating the energy and how we're approaching to fix those problems?
But let me take a brief crack at it and then maybe turn to Bill and see if he, because Bill is our greenhouse gas inventory guru for Oregon. It depends to some extent on whether we're looking at emissions per capita or emissions per sort of geographic subdivision. If it's geographic subdivision, clearly most of the emissions originate within the urban areas, because that's where most of the people are, and it's where most of the economic activity is going on. So you would expect the Portland metropolitan area, Eugene, Medford, Bend, to be the sources, certainly the primary sources of greenhouse gas emissions from transportation and from industrial activity. To the extent that you look at just electricity, a significant number of the, in fact, all of those coal emissions, therefore 25% of our overall emissions, don't even occur within the state of Oregon. They occur in Utah, Wyoming, and Montana, because that's where Pacific's coal plants are and PGE's remaining coal resource. So we kind of have to distribute those by utility service territory, and as I said, the bulk of those go into Pacific Power territory. PGE has Boardman still and a chunk of Colstrip. So it's after Boardman shuts down, it'll be maybe 12 to 14% coal denominated, but a lot of gas. You go into the rural parts of the state where they are primarily served by consumer-owned utilities. Those are mostly getting their electricity from either BPA or other hydropower systems. Eugene Water and Electric Board, for example, has its own hydropower resource that it operates. So almost none of the electricity-related greenhouse gas emissions come from consumer-owned territory. If you look on a per capita basis rather than a per geographic area basis and just look at, for example, emissions associated with vehicles, then on a per capita basis, those are mostly in rural areas because urban areas have so many other choices for how to get from point A to point B than driving, and they're relatively short driving distances. So we're trying to look at these. We have to slice this thing in a lot of different ways to really have a clear idea for not who's responsible, because that's really not the measure. It's really more where can the savings be most easily acquired. And the long and short answer to that is mostly in our urban areas. If I had to divide up the responsibilities, I say the rural areas' responsibilities are to be homes for the renewable energy projects, because they're mostly in rural areas, and we hope they bring prosperity to those areas, because they bring some other things as well. Saving energy, that mostly has to take place in the cities. Bill, do you want to?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Bailey, Representative Peterson. I'm Bill Dremhauer with the Oregon Department of Energy, although today I'm wearing my Global Warming Commission hat as staff. At 2 points, you're talking about sort of geographic specificity. I would one really important development I think that should be highlighted is the fact that the Department of Environmental Quality in the state now actually gets reporting data from specific facilities for greenhouse gas emissions. So actually, before we kind of had to do kind of these statewide estimates and modeling, we actually now have a lot of very good data that are now actually being incorporated into these broader inventory data. So we can not only talk about geographic specificity, we're talking like facility-level specificity. So that will actually really help, I think, now and in the future with those kind of questions. But it is important to remember, and I think sometimes we do forget, that there are emissions happening all over the state. Agricultural activity is roughly 8 to 9% of greenhouse gas emissions. Obviously, that's mainly in agricultural areas, livestock, you know, that kind of thing. So everyone has a role to play. Also, we measure emissions by the use of electricity. And electricity being used all over the state, and as Angus just mentioned, the Pacific Power serves a number of the rural areas. Even BPA has a small coal footprint. About 5 to 10% of BPA power comes from market purchases to sort of fill in the gaps with the hydro and whatnot, and that some of that actually comes from coal. So there is, there are these interesting geographic patterns, but those emissions can actually be attributed statewide.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, Representative Peterson, I would just add that despite the amount of press that occurs, cows actually contribute very, very little in greenhouse gases. And most of the emissions actually come from our transportation system and our electricity, and where that electricity comes from is really important. And as Angus said, in the rural areas, that's mostly BPA, which has a much lower carbon footprint than do the investor-owned utilities. But when you look at transportation, obviously rural folks drive a lot more than urban folks do, and they don't have access to as much transportation alternatives. So it depends where you look, but overall, most of it comes from the urban areas.
So remember, we left you on the note, guilt-free T-Bone Steak.
Yeah. Nice. Appreciate that. Okay. Thank you very much for this panel. We appreciate your testimony. Close the informational hearing on Oregon's Global Warming Commission biennial report. And open informational hearing on Columbia River Treaty Review. I'd like to call up Phil Ward and Crystal Ball, please.
Is mine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, I'm Phil Ward with the Oregon Water Resources Department, and my guess is we're a little tight on time at this point. Is that true?
We have 25 minutes.
Okay, so we'll, I think we can fit in that easily. With me is Crystal Ball today from the Bonneville Power Administration. I'm appreciative that she was able to join this morning for this brief update. Our job today is to talk a little bit about what's going on with the Columbia River Treaty. As you probably know, the Columbia River Treaty between the United States and Canada was ratified in the 1960s, primarily for the purposes of flood control and hydropower generation. And the U.S. Compensated Canada at that time for these things and continues to do so on an annual basis. The Columbia River Treaty doesn't expire, but either country can terminate this treaty in 2024 with a 10-year notice. And the assured flood control provisions of this treaty do expire in 2024. So this has led to a formal treaty review between the two states, which is currently underway. For the United States, this review is being led by BPA and the Army Corps of Engineers. They're known as the U.S. entity collectively. And they've established an advisory committee called a Sovereign Review Team, including the four Northwest states, the tribes, and other federal agencies to provide input into how the United States should approach this formal treaty review that's underway. BPA and the Corps have developed a draft regional recommendation ultimately, that will go to the U.S. Department of State based on seven principles that are in page three of the testimony that I passed out. I won't go through those right now unless you want to, but I would note that our timing for this hearing, Mr. Chair, is terrible because this the draft report is actually, as Crystal will tell you, due to be released in just a couple of days, so we don't have that. All I can give you is the principles on which that report is based on page three in the testimony. So the draft report will actually be released Friday, and I would note on pages 5 and 6 of your written testimony is a summary of the input that the state of Oregon provided for that draft report. So we talk about hydropower in Oregon's recommendations. We need to make sure that we have a flexible hydropower system in the future that is targeted both at making sure we do the generation we need to, but improving ecosystem function as well. We talk about the need for continued flood risk management. Obviously, the city of Portland is very interested in assuring that we have continued flood risk management. Ecosystem-based water quality functions, these are things that the original treaty did not countenance, and the state of Oregon is recommending that there be some attention paid to these issues in the next. And then the final is water supply. Actually, not the final, but close to the final is water supply. And this is something that the states of Washington and Oregon worked hard to get included in this treaty review. Is there an opportunity to provide water supply for both in-stream and out-of-stream use for irrigated agriculture and for ecosystem functions in a greater measure at the right times that would be accessible for use in the states of Oregon and Washington? The final three things, navigation, again, a continued priority that we have a navigable river under the provisions of the treaty. Recreation, the state of Oregon doesn't want to see any diminution of recreation opportunities in the basin as a result. And then a note that climate change certainly could alter the basin's hydrology in the years ahead, and we need to make sure that whatever we do in the treaty has enough adaptability in it that we can address those issues. So, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my remarks there and turn it over to Ms. Ball, if that's all right with you.
Thank you. Ms. Ball.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, my name is Crystal Ball. I'm the Oregon liaison at the Bonneville Power Administration. And as Director Ward pointed out, BPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers are the federal agencies responsible for implementing the treaty in the United States. We are on track to deliver a regional recommendation to the State Department for a post 2024 treaty construct. I want to mention that, as Director Ward said, the treaty doesn't terminate, but we can modify or terminate or enhance the treaty after 2024 with 10 years' notice. So it's important for us to get a regional recommendation to the State Department so that they can review that recommendation, vet it, and have a year to do so before 2014. Just to cover real quick the process for the remainder of the year, the State Department was in Portland last week, and they met with stakeholders. It was a great opportunity for the State Department to hear the different regional perspectives about the post-2024 treaty. And as Director Ward pointed out, there will be a draft recommendation available by the end of the week. We will share that broadly with the public in and then the public can review and comment on that draft recommendation through October. In October, we will have several public meetings in the four Northwest states. There will definitely be a public meeting in Oregon, in Portland, probably towards the end of the month. And we will make sure that there's an opportunity for people to listen into that meeting and comment as well if they're not able to attend in person. In November, we will review the public comment and make any necessary changes. And then, as I said before, we are on track to deliver that recommendation, a regional recommendation, to the State Department by the end of this year. That concludes my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions about the process.
Thank you. I almost feel you need to look down the dais, Representative Pence.
Chair, I don't know why you would do that to me, since you ask. So, when I was commenting on that, first of all, I want to thank you both for all your work. We really is appreciated, and of course, it's hugely important. It's interesting, the hydropower, flood risk, and ecosystem-based functions are. It suggested that ecosystem-based function be raised to the level of hydro and flood risk. And I spent a lot of time thinking about that, actually, because, of course, I wanted water supply to be up there also. But it's a challenge to make the argument. I did make it, ultimately, that I wanted use of water out of stream to be considered on that same level as those other three super important issues. But it's challenging. And so I would just ask you two, just if you could comment just a bit on that, because the way it turned out, the way this reads, it shows the ecosystem moves up and enjoys the same priority as flood risk and hydropower, but not so much for water supply.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, so I think certainly this process has been one of a negotiation. And there was definitely broad-based support for the ecosystem function piece as through this whole process. The water supply piece was a relatively new ask, to be frank. And the states of Washington and Oregon initiated that ask in terms of particularly the out-of-stream component. And there has been some controversy related to that. What we're really encouraged about is that it was indeed included as a formal task piece in the core scoping work now, and so we do have it as a part of the equation. Ultimately, where that ends up in the final analysis is yet to be seen, but I know the states of Oregon and Washington continue to be committed to advancing that concept as a part of this dialogue.
Thank you.
Committee, part of the intention of having this update is that we have passed a piece of legislation in the last session that will continue to ask that we track this process. I think it's helpful for the committee to have a scoping and an overview of what the issues are on the table and the timeline for those issues so that as we engage over the course of the interim and going into next session, we are prepared, we have the framework in the background to be able to receive that input and be able to track it. We're appreciative of the work that you're doing, the federal government's doing on our behalf. It is clearly one that is of extreme
economic and environmental importance to Oregonians, and I'm appreciative to Representative Bentz for his work to make sure that that is legislatively squarely on our radar screen. So with that, without seeing any further questions, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Okay.
And we'll close the informational hearing on, what are we calling it? Columbia River Treaty Review. And anything else for the good of the order, committee?
So we'll have three committee bills in February, correct?
Three committee bills and whatever else you all decide to bring.
All right.
All right.
Sorry, missed that.
Well, we will. There are three bills allocated to the committee. We have not yet decided what those will be.
Okay.
And
right.
The implementation timeline will be announced. Last session it was five.
I didn't know they limited our committee bills.
Yeah, we'd never get out of here.
It's true.
Okay, with that, committee's adjourned.
Three meetings would be done.
Committee's adjourned.
Three meetings would be done.
Okay, with that.